meeting and ask for attendance to be taken to determine if we have a quorum. May you please take the attendance.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 6th. If I call your name, just let us know that you're here. Mr. Ian Thomas.
Here.
Mr. Henry Robinson.
Here.
Mr. Ivan Perrone.
Here.
And Mr. Ray Monteleone.
Here.
And then we have a few guests from PFM. We have Richard Pengali.
And PFM Asset Management.
Welcome. And Laura Howe.
From PFM Financial Advisors.
And I'm Nicole Scott from the Treasurer's Office, and I'm going to hand it back to
and
you.
Who is absent?
So we have Dane Sheldon, a community member that is not present at the moment, and we have two staff members
that their positions will
need to be filled, yes.
Okay.
What about
Dane?
No. Shelley.
Oh, Shelley kind of did not get renewed either.
Really?
Shelley and Ole.
Oh, okay.
Right.
In any event, so that I will meet, I always get confused if you and I can meet on non-administrative without announcing it, Ivan, because you are a voting member of the committee under Sunshine. If you were a non-voting member, I know we can meet.
Correct.
Okay? But you are a voting member. So why don't we set up a meeting? You're all welcome. And we're going to talk about administrative issues, board, committee participation, and so on. Okay? We'll call it a workshop to discuss it. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine. I just want to let you know that I was planning to submit.
I'm planning to resign. Go ahead.
Not yet. To submit the, because I already had two candidates that I thought would do well here as a staff member. And I'm going to send them to the interim CFO, which is Paul Marsham, see if he can sign it, and that way we would have the two members hopefully by the next meeting.
Excellent. Which is in November.
So we'll set up this workshop that we all can go to and we can talk about the future of the committee and board members and so on. And the reason I said that is I had the impression that Dane was resigning from the committee.
That was my, yeah, I did have a conversation with him maybe like 3 weeks ago. And he said that he was getting himself together and everything. He had some health issues. But he said that he still wanted to be a member, that he would will make every effort to attend the meetings. So that's why nothing happened in that respect.
So we'll talk about that situation. We can check on his health and so on before the workshop. Let's try to do the workshop before October 15th.
Okay.
So that gives us a little over a month, just so we kind of get in place. And I also like it for our visiting guests here. They know who they're doing business with and who they got to present to that's on here. Okay, so we do not have a quorum, so we will not take any formal action, but I will take executive privilege by saying we will have discussions on issues and reports and questions and so on, and if, even though we can't act, we can always reach consensus of those present and what the thinking is, at least so we can record it and know where we are under certain circumstances and make our time here appropriate. So with that, the approval of the minutes will be deferred to the next meeting for which there is a quorum. I see no one here from the public. Was the public afforded a phone-in number?
It's in person.
Okay, so we didn't afford one. Good. All right. So there's no one from the public here. If you can keep an eye out if someone from the public shows up, flag me and then we'll deal with it appropriately. So now, old business, which is the investment advisor and the financial advisor. And I want to just share an anecdote before you started. I, not by choice, became the chairman of Broward College's foundation, the DSO. And I'm now up to my ears in issues with, they had an advisor, not a manager, or they didn't utilize the outsourced investment officer structure that some people use, that's on there. And we pulled out of the RFP that the college had done because nobody discussed having a manager instead of an advisor. So we pulled out for the foundation, and we're gonna get caught up in that process. Now, I'm not doing that as a public announcement. I'm doing that to tell you that I have had to get even more of an education about the things you all are going to report on than I've had before. More than I ever wanted to figure things out as to what takes place here. So I have to ask this question. Is it truly a financial advisor here, or do you have discretion to do trades without having the check with us?
We have discretion. Right, so you set the investment policy. That gives us our, you know, guidelines. You can only invest in these types of securities, only so much. You have to manage to this benchmark, etc.
So how would you describe the role? What would you call the role?
A discretionary investment manager.
Thank you. I would, for the sake of, if I get nailed by the newspapers with all that's going on at this other organization, okay? Can we change, going forward on the agenda, what it is they are? That they're not the investment advisor?
Well, there's two different, because we're financial advisors. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're saying, investment advisor, I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's different thing.
Leave us advisor.
You're an advisor.
Yes. Okay.
That's
just
clear.
Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no, that part, that's
okay.
What I'm saying.
Okay.
But the first one, can we change it to what it really is? And if you're trying to be clear, if we just look at their agreement, it'll be stated in there, you know, what they are. And then if it's not, yeah, we can coin the phrase that you want, but I don't want to call it an advisor because I know somebody is going to go on me and say, but how come, you know, you're always telling us how good the school board investment people are operating and why can't we operate that way and blah, 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 blah. And then they would see the advisor. So when I got the agenda the other day and read it, all this stuff was going on. So I at least wanted to explain to everybody why I'm saying that. That's on there.
So
lengthy explanation, but that's it.
What is your request?
My request is to change the title on the agenda to what they really are. They're not just an advisor. They have, as he described it, help her out with the words after
investment
meeting.
Manager.
Investment yeah. manager.
Right.
Which is what I'm used to okay. utilizing when you got the kind of funds that we have, because you with Sunshine, you slow down the process if you have an advisor, if you need to react on the moment. We had a situation where we had to call an emergency meeting of the Finance and Investment Committee, okay, to get rid of a stock or an investment that was in trouble because the SEC was investigating this and that. So it took days before they could do the trade. If we had a manager and you'd realize what it is, bam, you would just do it, report back why you did it, and so on, and that'd be the end of it. So I don't want to sit in something. Now, we are an advisor to the board, okay? So they're a manager of the fund. The board's the one that actually directs or does what has to take place with our guidance. But I just wanted to clear that up here. Is everybody fine with that? No problems? Yeah. Consensus here?
I think it's good. It's clear now.
Yeah.
So it's good that we make that change.
Okay. So why don't we kick off with our investment manager report?
Okay, so we'll start off. So the results here, the charts and everything are as of the end of the second calendar quarter, so 6/30. Oh,
page 5.
I'm sorry, page 5. Yeah, just page 5. I will update things as we, you know, as we go along, since it seems like everything's changed in the past month or so here.
Bless you.
Bless you. But yeah, starting on page 5, I think the kind of trends that are shown here really reflect what we've seen. So, you know, recall at the end of last year, the Fed came out in December and basically communicated to the market that they think that they've increased rates enough that they can really start to look towards pivoting to lowering interest rates. So we spent, you know, the early part of the year thinking about, well, when might the Fed actually lower interest rates? The Fed projected at that time that they thought they'd lower overnight rates by 0.75%. The market heard twice that. They heard 1.5%, kind of like they did the year before and the year before that. They predicted that the second half we'd see a recession, right? That seems to be the go-to view of the market. And the go-to view is based on the fact that the Fed has a terrible record of trying to slow the economy down without crashing it and putting it in recession, right?
Terrible record.
So, I mean, the past 40 years, they've only done it, I think, once, right, which is in the early 90s. So, so that was the situation going into the beginning of the year. And then data that had been showing a slowing economy, all of the data that came in the first quarter, all of the surprises were indicating a hotter economy than expected. Employment was stronger than expected. The inflation numbers were stickier than expected. You recall the last couple of meetings kept saying how inflation was sticky. And the chart on page 5 sort of brings all of all this together. It's the Citibank Surprise Index, where they basically look at economic data and say, if we compare what the projections are, what the forecasts are, to what the actual numbers are, is it showing a hotter economy or a weaker economy? And all of the data in the first part of the year, all the surprise indicated a stronger economy, a tight labor market, hotter inflation, etc.
So the end of December of 22, it was bad news. I'm following the chart.
Yes.
Then it started to go up, then we had a dip, then it went up again for a period in time, and then December of 23, it went down again, and then got a little better. Am I reading it right?
Exactly.
And now it's in the tubes.
Exactly. Now, and then since then, the last part of last quarter and the beginning of this quarter, what we've seen is basically surprises indicating a weaker economy. Looser employment conditions, lower inflation than projected, so generally indicating that things are worsening in the economy overall, right? So that's what we've seen and continue to see, you know,
surprise,
past year, right?
Is it really a surprise? Because I've heard many times that when they produce the reports, a month later they revise the numbers.
Right, so we've seen that. We just saw it this morning with the labor data, with a, you know, last month they projected there were 175,000 net new jobs was the estimate.
Right.
Then the actual number that came in, or the advanced number, was 114,000. That's been revised further down to 89,000.
Is that what it is today? I didn't hear, I just knew it was down.
Yeah.
89,000.
Yes, so it was the revision for last month's number. For July's number. August number came in at 142,000 versus, I think it was 160-something thousand is what was projected. So weaker than projected. So again, another surprise kind of on the downside.
Like we can't get it right the first time.
Well, I mean, you know, it takes a lot for them to really figure those numbers out, right?
But yeah. What astounds me is the use, not but you, well, you have to do what you got to do and say what you got to say. But like you said, it's not really a surprise. Okay? I mean, you just, there was an article came out yesterday that the recent graduates, that's with undergraduate and graduate degrees, this people who graduated this year have a 50% less chance of getting a job than they did last year.
That would make sense, yeah.
Okay? And my granddaughter happens to fit in that thing, and all she's trying to do, she's interning for me now, okay, because she's going to start her doctorate in psychology, all right? So she's just in the middle of doing that. So it's not a disaster. But she's got two friends, one from an Ivy League school, another one from Georgetown, had gigantic jobs that were supposed to start September 1, okay? Postponed until March. Now, unless you're supported by your parents, how do you get postponed on a job? And these were high-paying jobs that they were getting that's out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, flip to page 7, right? And, you know, the chart on the right shows the difference between job openings, right, versus the unemployment rate, right? So the ratio of people who are looking for work but don't have a job versus, you know, companies that are looking for positions. And we went from a high in May of 2, so for every person that was unemployed, there were 2 openings out there, down to 1.2, which is basically in line with where we were pre-pandemic, 1.1 something, you know, pre-pandemic. So yeah, the market was much better last year and the year before than it is now, right? We're kind of back to more normalized conditions. And that's kind of, I think, the theme right now, and what everyone's trying to figure out: are we seeing a normalization, or is it a weakening, right? Are we, you know, are we on the precipice of recession, or are we just normalizing off of these extremely tight conditions that we had over the past couple of years?
And how does that, I mean, I hear reports about the border and all these people coming in. Are they getting jobs, or how's that affecting the job market?
And if they're getting jobs, do they get counted? Because since they're illegals, they don't have I-9s, right, they don't have any of these things, so they might not be in reported.
They're not included.
So they're not only not being reported because they're illegal, they're filling a spot for somebody who could work.
Yeah, so I don't know, I don't have, you know, all of the numbers at hand on that, but, you know, where we did see some of that play out is in the prior unemployment number, right? So here we show June at 4.1%, in July it went up to 4.3%, and then today it was reported at 4.2%, so it came down a little bit. But part of what has played into that number is immigration. That there were more people who indicated that they're looking for jobs. And I don't know what component. I know they break up the migrants into those who come and report and say, I'm looking for asylum, and they're waiting, versus the ones who are, you know, just not counted. But part of the increase were people who were new arrivals, immigrants who were here looking for a job, and yet, you know, are going to go through sort of a 3 to 6 month period before they actually are able to get placed in a job, and that helped kind of drive up that number.
And also, do you know government versus private, who's hiring?
I don't have those numbers.
Well, does Broward have a hiring freeze right now?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Non-teacher, right?
Non-teacher.
Teacher, they're still short, but hiring freeze, non-teacher. That's what I thought. And that's not unique. I was speaking to somebody at the state DOE, and they're telling me that's pretty much prevalent throughout. Yeah. So even with the population growth that we've had down here, then the teacher part is lacking, but the administrative, everybody's holding on.
Yeah, our budgets are frozen. They only give us a quarter allocation, so we can't spend like we used to. So they're monitoring all that at the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if government's still hiring, and if it's a plateau or not.
Yeah, I don't have kind of where who's hiring and not hiring. I don't have that breakdown.
In the feds, all I heard was the IRS is still hiring.
No, I'm not surprised.
I haven't heard about
it. The other people going out the door.
Who's going out the door?
A lot of IRS people are leaving.
Why is that?
They're getting to that age.
They're taking the pensions.
They're taking the pension and running. Uh-huh. And they're outsourcing some of that stuff also behind the scenes. So sometimes when you call the IRS, you're not speaking to somebody who's a normal full-time resident of the IRS. It's all outsourced.
They sometimes have accents you can't believe you're talking to the IRS.
Outsourcing to India?
That wouldn't be so bad.
Just great. And then how AI is going to affect all this.
Well, yeah. That's
garbage in and garbage out. Put info in.
I learned it 3 months ago in a meeting, and I'm using it. AI absolutely can't be dependent on.
No.
It hallucinates. Yeah, that was the phrase.
Yeah. So anyway, labor markets are normalizing, definitely, getting weaker, back to normal. We don't know yet, right? We'll know in 6 months or so.
Things are not great.
So inflation, which, we spent the last 24 months talking about.
What page are we on?
I'm on page 6.
Okay.
So inflation continues to come down towards the Fed target. On page 6, we show core CPI, which is headline inflation, the consumer price index. That's the one you usually see in the papers. In May here, it was at 3.4%. The July reading was 3.2% for the core. So again, trending lower. And then core PCE, which is the Fed's measure of personal consumption expenditures, 2.6 in May, and then in July it was 2.6 again for that number.
So, and these are comparing beginning year to now, to whatever time period you're measuring. So if we had, I'm just exaggerating, if we had a 10% inflation at the beginning of the year, okay, how does that then impact what we have now? How do they measure that? In other words, they're not coming up with a norm, they're just doing the variance and that change, right? But what are they changing from when they're doing it? I mean, when I look at one commodity,
right.
I sit there and say I was paying X dollars for gasoline last year and I'm paying Y dollars now, okay? It's up X percent.
Yeah, so essentially that's the same calculation they're doing. They take some basket of goods and services, aggregate that, weight it, and then come up with an index value, and then they measure that change from period to period. They do it on a monthly basis and then change
it. So whatever in that bucket
is
what deals with it. That's excellent, thank you.
I understand that, but when I go to the supermarket, I don't feel any difference.
Oh, food hasn't come down.
Right.
Feel a lot lighter.
Well,
yeah, it got worse.
So we've seen inflation, right? So what we're seeing now is disinflation, which means that the rate of increase is slowing down, but it's still increasing, right? But you want a deflation.
That's the point.
You want inflation.
That's the point.
You want to see a negative number there, right?
We're bleeding, but we're not bleeding as fast.
Right. There you go. Now some things are actually cheaper. So cars have been coming down.
What about
clothes? Clothes has been coming down, and some components of food and toys have been coming down.
But those three have come down because the three you brought up, demand is down. They had priced cars so high that people couldn't afford it. And with the interest rates, they can't afford it.
They can't afford
it's
it.
It's like housing. Yeah, cars now follows housing.
Right. $800
a month for a car payment.
We're not in a good shape.
Yeah, I saw dealerships are doing like 60-month, 2.5% financing through them, which is
really the car deal. The
it's
car
a, yeah,
company subsidized.
Right. Yeah. Anyhow, sorry.
So,
do you have any good news? keep putting my hand on my watch and it's talking. I'm getting all the questions from my watch. This is AI.
So if we jump to page 9, I think page 9 kind of pulls those two ideas together. How consumers have been doing versus how inflation has been going. So wages have been increasing, right? That was one of the factors driving inflation because of the tight labor markets. Employers had to pay more for workers that were in demand. So we've gotten to the point where the gains in wages have kept pace with inflation. If you look at them cumulatively over time. Although for most folks, you know, maybe you get a wage increase once a year, but you know, you from week to week sort of see the prices going up in the stores. So, like you said, it doesn't.
Do they have a correlation between? I'll use the McDonald's California example. They raised the minimum wage, so the McDonald's employees in California got an increase in wage. And then they immediately laid off 20% of the employees. All right, so now unemployment goes up, even though the wage level is higher. Does anybody monitor that?
I don't know.
I'm just.
Know. But yes, I mean that. That specific case, I don't know about that. But I think one thing that we have seen, though, generally, is that consumers continue to spend, right? So on the same page, on page 9, we show the retail sales numbers, which have continued to be very, very robust. That's why we've seen pretty strong GDP numbers for the year and projections for the remainder of the year. And we've seen earnings projections for companies also remain.
We're not hitting the cap on the credit card debt. I thought we were getting close to that. In other words, consumption was up because they were using their credit cards.
So we have seen an increase in credit card usage, but still not at kind of alarming levels when we compare to, let's say, the global financial crisis, right? And what we saw
that
time of period, right? So we still haven't seen things get to those alarm level. Now, one thing that we that's maybe new now that we didn't have before, these buy now pay later apps, right? So fintech, these kind of lending services like Affirm, Afterpay, Klarna, I think is another one. This is kind of a new phenomenon where we don't really have good metrics around how much utilization there is of those services compared to traditional credit.
Because the vendors are financing it with the deferred, the deferred or no interest if you pay off. That's interesting.
Yeah, so it could be that you have consumers who have more debt maybe than is reflected in kind of the numbers, the metrics we usually look at. But that being said, it tends to be maybe a lower FICO type of consumer that's taking advantage of these services. So I'll touch on this a little bit when we get to kind of talk about spreads. So what's an interesting thing is even though maybe consumers have a little more debt in aggregate, when you look at the higher FICO consumers, those pools are actually stronger because the other weaker credits are using these other services.
So. Well, I don't travel that often, but I did travel a few times in the past few months. I see the airports are pretty busy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of activity going on. So,
yeah,
are we hurting?
Yeah, company reports. I mean, you know, Walmart came out, they reported that, they were doing very well. So it's.
But the retail receivables are up, and the credit cards balances are up. And I didn't think of the one you just brought up, because now you can buy furniture, equipment for the garden and everything on these no interest or for a year, 2 years, et cetera, and if that's not being recorded. Yeah. And they got a lot of flight sales too, you know.
It amazes me, but I also read on the Wall Street Journal, dollar stores, I think.
Yeah, Dollar General, Dollar Store.
They were not doing very well.
Yeah.
They had to revise their forecast down. And so they taking a hit, and that's interesting because, you know, usually in a low economic environment, those places do very well.
Is so, Walmart going up though?
Yeah, they're the same. Yeah. So Walmart, part of the thing they, you know, why Walmart is doing better is because higher income consumers they're attracting those consumers into their stores. So yeah, I don't know if it was the same article or a different one, but you know, the journal also kind of did this piece on how there's a bifurcation, right? You've got kind of, you know, a lot of this retail sales numbers and, you know, consumer strength being driven by sort of the upper half and you know, lower incomes, you know, kind of increasingly getting worse or having worse conditions.
Yeah, yeah, luxury brands like Gucci and some other ones, they're doing pretty well. This environment.
Yeah.
So I found that interesting with Dollar General reducing or lowering the forecasting.
That's discretionary.
So, right, they're heading for not good times ahead.
But the fast food industry, many of those are closing down locations.
It's a mixed signal everywhere.
Try to find a BurgerFi now, for example, in South Florida. There's very few.
Get that crystal ball,
Richard. Yeah, get it out, right?
You gotta polish it a little bit more.
Speaking of crystal ball, right? So, page 10. So page 10, and I guess maybe this sort of leads into page 11, the sort of Fed projections. So, you know, are we seeing kind of this alarm recession type, you know, view being priced into the market? You know, looking at a couple of things, it doesn't seem like that's what we're seeing. So we do see maybe an indication of weakness or a soft landing, right? A normalization rather, but not necessarily a recession. So if we look at corporate spreads, so the spreads on, you know, corporate asset backs and things like that compared to government bonds, those spreads are lower than their long-term averages. So we showed June spread, for example, on the table on page 10, investment grade spreads at 86 basis points compared to the long-term 20-year average at, you know, 118 basis points. High yield spreads, so junk bond spreads, same thing, they're not priced as if there's an expectation of a recession in the market when you compare to longer term yield spreads. And then we also show, you know, equity dividend yields, again, not indicating that the market is pricing in recession conditions. Looking at rates, so on page 11, you know, we show this is the June Fed forecast where they saw rates would be at the end of the year and subsequently. At that time, they were only projecting one cut by the end of the year, which was a change from the prior forecast of three cuts. Right now, if we look at Fed funds futures, the market has 100% probability of a cut coming in a couple weeks at the next Fed meeting. And then sort of even odds, I think, as of this morning, of whether it's going to be 50 basis points or a quarter point cut.
So when they make those expectations, is it based on the financial data they view, they think the common sense result would be? Or is it that people are just leaking?
Well, when you said the Fed funds futures or the Fed's projection?
Fed's projection.
Fed's projection. So the Fed, I mean, makes their projection. Each one of the officials, you know, gives an estimate, I guess, based on their own research and their own view of where they're going to set, where they think they'll be setting the rate by the end of the year.
So they're signaling the cut.
Yeah, they're saying, so each one, you know, each one of those dots is a person who says, based on my whole team's research here, this is where I think it's going to be at the end of the year. And then the end of next year, following year, et cetera. And then the, on the right-hand side, this is also where they estimate where we think the neutral rate is. This is where we think long-term overnight rate should be to keep inflation in balance and full employment and everything in balance.
How would that equate to a mortgage rate based on history, to a relationship?
That is a good question. So this is the overnight rate. Mortgage rates are usually tied to the 10-year treasury rate, which is driven kind of more by longer-term inflation expectations. You can, I guess, build off of this rate some inflation expectation and sort of back out and forecast what the 10-year rate is. We actually have a way that we build up the rate, which I don't recall, but I can kind of follow up with. But you could build off of this rate and say, here's what my inflation expectation is, and here's what my estimate is, the neutral rate for where the 10-year should be.
Because I was trying to figure from looking at this, the 2.7, the longer term.
Right.
You know, is that going to keep us at a 6% mortgage rate? I'm just using as an example, versus what we saw a couple of years ago, you know, 3.5% and 4% mortgage rates, which is going to impact development and all this other stuff. But the problem we got in South Florida down here, because I know the teachers are running into this, as are the police and medical and all that other stuff, is housing here is like unbelievable. The rental cost is on the moon. So it used to be, I can't afford to buy, so I'll rent.
Right.
Now people can't afford to rent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had somebody, two professors making X thousand a year, couldn't afford a place, so they had to bring in a third, mm-hmm. just to be able to stay in the same one they were living in. Because the lease was up and they upped it. And the school district hasn't done anything about housing yet, have they? Have they taken any action?
They're looking to see if they can do something, some P3s or something.
Let me ask you this. The rate cut that's expected this month, have they gave any indication would it be 50 basis points or a full point or anything of that nature? And just to piggyback on that, would Powell be looked at favorably or unfavorably with the election coming up if this happens?
Depends on which side you're on. How you
answer the first one, then go to the second because I want to hold on to my chair.
So the first one is, you know, everything they've indicated is data dependent. To be in line with this view that they're in control of things, then they would probably want to do a 25 basis point cut.
25. Okay.
Yes, if they did a 50 basis point cut, it would probably signal that maybe they know more, there's something they're seeing or that they know to indicate things are weaker than expected, and it would probably cause, you know, probably more volatility in the market than if they did a 25 basis point cut. Even though you've got a bunch of people who are pricing in kind of these weird conditions, I think if you talk to a bunch of economists, they'd say they really should be doing, you know, a 25 basis point cut, right? They pause, things are supposedly trending as expected, and then now we'll start on the path of a steady set of rate cuts. So I think that would probably be the preferred thing, would be to do a 25 basis point cut rather than 50 basis point cuts. 50 basis point cuts, if you look back over, you know, past 10, 20 years, whatever, generally have been done in emergency situations, right? So so it'd probably be not the kind of signal that they'd want to send. And then the favorable versus unfavorable, I think if you're the incumbent party, you probably want a rate cut and easing financial conditions versus if you're in opposition, right? So.
Okay.
But there's not supposed to be any connection.
Right.
Right.
But they're independent. They're independent. They're supposed to be independent. Data dependent.
Andy Jackson said they're going to be independent.
So, you know, so the forecast is 25, well, the forecast is that there'll definitely be a cut. Like I said, the futures market, you know, half the people are saying that, you know, we think it'll be 25, the other half thinks it'll be 50. And then overall, the market has 100 basis points of cut, so a full percentage point lower in overnight rates by the end of the year.
So if it's a 50 basis points, the administration had more influence, the present administration, than the other. So it'll look better going into November.
Okay.
And coincidentally, it'll happen before November.
And the other, the opposition will say power because of.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you just have to have two TV sets on, so you got two different channels when they deliver the report.
Yeah.
My right eye is conservative, my left eye is liberal. I never thought at almost 77 that I'm going to be living through times like this.
All right, so jumping to page 13. So 13, this shows the yield curve at the end of June 30. Rates are much lower since then.
Who decides this physically?
I mean, this is the market, right?
No. Who? When we say the marketplace,
yeah.
The actual interest rate on the Treasury bond,
yeah.
Who decides that?
It's buyers and sellers trading back and forth.
So they don't set they don't issue the bond. I'm thinking about how we do it here, right? We look at the marketplace and we do this and that. We contemplate for it to be X, and then when it gets out in the marketplace, maybe a little less than X, okay, type thing. How does it physically happen with the federal T-bills?
Right, so when they're pricing, they work with, I guess, a group of underwriters, as you do as well, the primary dealers, and they, you know, issue through them. You know, the dealers are communicating with the buyers of those bonds and, you know, I guess, giving guidance on the process.
So it is a replica of what we do?
I believe so. That's my understanding of the market. So I don't know if you know differently.
And that's, I mean, but our curve that we're, what that's based off of is also what's actually happening in the market based on what, you know, investors are driving. So our BVALF curve that moves as well.
But odds a wider base of investors, whereas the T-bill is like a single commodity that's on there. So
there's still secondary trades going on, and that drives the,
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. The secondary trades. That
right.
makes sense.
And there's a wider, I mean, you have more issuers, but
right.
you have a wider set of buyers, right, for the T-bills. I mean, the entire world is buying any issue of T-bills. There's a bunch of other T-bills already existing, so, you know, that price is not going to come in a vacuum, given that there's already supply out there, a lot of other supply.
Will the BRIC situation impact that at all? You know, the switch in the currency and all these countries jumping on board to take our currency out versus the Chinese currency?
I mean, it would impact the demand if there are, you know, currency things that are going on, right? Because foreign central banks hold treasuries, based on their need for dollars and their trade with the U.S., but so that would impact it. But I know there was a lot of discussion about that, you know, maybe a year and a half ago. It's hard to see in the near term a major shift away from the U.S. dollar. I mean, long term, you know,
because what there's over 100 countries now. That is signing on to BRIC, right?
I believe something like that.
Yes.
And then Saudi Arabia also changed.
Oh,
selling oil from dollar to Brent, right, or something?
Yeah, I think they're changing to the Chinese currency.
The yen. Really, that's what the whole deal is.
The yen is BRICS?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh.
BRICS started with Brazil.
Right.
Iran's in there too.
And Iran.
Yeah.
But I think it's the yen, the conversion to the yen versus the US dollar that's on there.
No.
So your point is short term should not have much of an impact.
Right. But long term, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would if there is less central bank demand for dollars. Yes, it would.
So. So that's not good for us in the long term.
No, that's what I'm worried about. That's why I'm saying it. That our T-bills, the interest rate may go up because they'll need it to attract the currency because it's not the fallback currency.
It would, absolutely. Yeah.
So our debt service goes up.
Right.
Federal debt service. And I hope you have good news when we get to
you.
So I'm gonna have to buy some Chinese money.
We want wonton soup and chow mein for the next meeting.
Well, before we move off of this one, I will indicate that yields are lower than what's shown here by almost 100 basis points across the curve. We're showing the 2-year to 4.75. It's at, I guess from the last look, it was at 3.65 for the 2-year. The 10-year we show here to 4.40. It's at a 3.68 again as of this morning. So yields are quite a bit lower, which you see translated to higher returns for the calendar third quarter. As I mentioned before, spreads have generally been tame compared to historical averages. And I'm going to jump to page 19. Overall returns in all sectors were good for the quarter, and you'll see in a second for your portfolio. Page 30. So the snapshot of the long-term portfolio at the end of the quarter. You recall a year ago we had initiated again the process to change the benchmark. Which has worked out actually really well in the portfolio. I was talking to the trader this morning. The portfolio manager said that you actually have $800,000 of gains in the portfolio. You performed a little bit better than if you had stayed at the 1-3 index. You've been able to buy some of these, buy longer term bonds where you were limited to 3-year. We're now able to go out to 5 years, which has worked very well in this declining interest rate. So it's been positive for the portfolio. It continues to be high credit quality, diversified, well diversified. And your returns are on page 37. For the quarter, the return was 0.94 versus 0.93% for the benchmark. So you outperformed the benchmark for the 3 months. The 1 year, you underperformed because the fourth quarter, calendar quarter of last year was the year that we're transitioning, the period we're transitioning to the new benchmark. So you underperformed the new benchmark in that period. But since
just
then,
that quarter.
Just that quarter, yeah. So if you look on page 38, actually, you can see the fourth quarter of 2023 was when you had the transition. So that's the quarter of underperformance. But the quarter since then, first calendar quarter of this year, second calendar quarter of this year, you outperformed the benchmark. I'll pause there for any questions.
What page can I glean quickly what our portfolio is, you know, in the Nash and so on.
That's the best page. Yeah, so page 31.
I was close now. Okay. I always bring up the international. That's why I'm trying to look at is how much are we invested in international. And I can't see it on this page.
So by international, you mean
not U.S. companies.
Yeah. We have a report that does show that.
I know somewhere. I just couldn't find it. That's why.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's in here. I don't think you have that, but I could have that generated.
Could you? And because my question on that is, primarily when we invest overseas, you know, it's the Japan, Hong Kong, all that arena, but mainly Europe and the European countries. And right now, as we talk about, I mean, Europe's in a world of, other than Hungary, Europe's in a world of hurt right now.
I don't think we invest internationally, unless they're companies.
Well, we used to, and then we started.
So these would be, you know, US dollar or the US, you know, subsidiary of these particular companies, right, or the entities that we invest in, right? So we've got like...
So for example, we have not invested in a Swiss company.
No.
We used to, when I first got on this committee. That's a good example, Nestle.
Nestle, yeah.
But the theory we moved to, and I think you're right, you're reminding me, right, is that if they had U.S. operations,
right,
and we thought that'd be strong,
right,
it was a good enough of, yes, investment.
Right.
Yeah.
If they didn't have U.S. operations, or if U.S. operations were tiny, okay, that we would, right, not go that. That's still kind of what you,
yes,
think.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's the... You, like most governments, are, you know, not necessarily trying to put their operating funds in a bunch of foreign companies. So some of these are, you know, foreign, you know, owned names, but we're investing in the U.S., you know, the U.S. entity,
right,
associated with that company.
Because I see major problems on the horizon short term,
right,
economically, especially the U.K.
Well, that's a challenge, I mean, even for your big U.S. companies, right? Because a lot of them have, I forgot what the metric was, but if you look at the S&P 500, in aggregate, they have something like 30 or 40% of their revenue is international. So even though they're U.S. companies, you know, kind of disaggregated them, they're substantially international.
Ivan, how has your overnight yields been coming?
I don't have a record with me right now. But
yeah, I mean, just last fiscal year.
Yeah, well, most of it is held with Chase.
Okay.
So we have an earnings credit on that, and we're doing pretty well.
That sort of goes against it.
Yeah, so we have, they invest all that money and pays off the banking fees.
The banking fees?
Yes.
Okay.
That's,
but you have something over and above.
Is there any...
Our investments.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is there any question we didn't ask that we should have?
I mean, I can't think of any. I think
he always takes an extra drink on the train back after his meals.
He doesn't wait. He goes straight to the bar.
Right. I don't think so. I mean, I think the questions from the committee, as a general matter, you're much more cautious probably than maybe the general view about where the economy is heading. So so your more pessimistic view and questioning, I think you kind of you kind of asked all the questions.
I admit it. So. Another excellent report.
Yeah.
And we appreciate what you do for us.
Yes, definitely.
And I feel so much more relieved that that manager's in there. Okay, and now a true advisor.
Before I dive into this, I know you had said November 5th for the next meeting, and that's a Tuesday. Is that the correct, or is it the 15th? A Friday. I just wanted to confirm. Because I had on my calendar the 15th.
What lucky
is that election day?
The 5th is, yes.
There could be a typo.
Okay.
Because they are usually on Fridays.
And because we
so.
Had all kinds of staff changes, as you feel you have pained through this year with poor Patricia's death, okay? Every date you got now, she's cleared?
I believe so.
Do me a favor and double-check Monday.
This is one, yeah.
Yeah, double-check Monday.
I think I did a few months back.
For those who didn't know, but my almost 30-year assistant and associate passed away. It was just a year ago, et cetera. And none of that stuff ever went, right? There was never a problem. We always had dates. We knew everything's on that. But the replacements have not done as well. So it's caused significant problems for them, and I apologize on the record about it. That's on there. So I don't want to cause a problem for you guys either. I can't be in California and Florida on the same day, you know, an hour apart. The commute time's
work.
A little heavy.
Let's make it a call you. AI, just generate your image at one meeting, right?
Technology, FaceTime.
I'm still a believer that I get much more accomplished in person than I ever do on the screen.
I agree.
And I learn more because body language means a lot to me when I'm getting information poured at me. Especially when we do the RFP stuff as a committee. Doing those on the screen would never work because I couldn't deal with that. But that's just personal preference. Okay.
So I'll dive in. I wouldn't say nothing.
You're gonna answer my first question. Are you going to give better news than we just had?
Well, it's neutral news.
Okay.
Some of it will be good. The market update, and Richard had alluded to this, so if you go to page 4, rates are starting to drop, you know, with the anticipation that the Fed is going to be lowering rates in September. The market already kind of starts to bake that in now. So the graphic on page 4 on the right, the solid red line is where we currently are. So. I'm optimistic that we're going to start to see the actual curve that we're supposed to see and get rid of this inversion that we've had for so long now. But you look at the red to where the dotted gray line was at the top of where we were a year ago. So one, the curve is starting to smooth out as well, but rates are declining from where we were a year ago. The chart on the left, the blue bars represent the range over 10 years of where those have been from years 1 to 30. The yellow is where we currently are, and then the average is the orange diamonds down there. So we're still above, but rates are trending down. That will be good because next year the district does have several callable bonds that I know Ivan's already getting inundated with pitch books that they're wanting to do the forwards now that we're going to wait because we're not going to pay up a premium when we anticipate rates to drop. And so that is positive that rates are trending down for the district on the borrowing side.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Ivan, do you give a report to this committee on those things at all, you know, like as they're happening?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And we'll be coming to you probably most likely in February, maybe November, just to be able to talk about the approvals just so we're ready to move for the refundings when it's time, because obviously that has to get an action item.
What's the magnitude that that would be?
I'll have to look at the numbers. I mean, I think you're going to be seeing at least 6%, but for current, there'll be current refundings, and so the policy dictates you have to have a minimum of 3% savings on those.
No, that's not my point.
Oh.
Magnitude meaning how many millions of dollars?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I would say there's a geo bond that's coming up.
Right.
That we could look at. I think there's two different of the 2015 series, so I would
correct.
Say anywhere between 100 and 250 million, but I don't have the numbers.
I was just trying to get
yeah.
the magnitude.
But we will provide all of that in a high level detail or a much more detailed presentation for you once we ask for your approval to be able to move forward with those refundings. But I just wanted to say the rates
what do you
are tricky.
Think you could commit to as far as getting that information to us prior to our meeting? A week, 2 weeks?
I think we normally send in the presentations at least a week before the meeting.
But that one's a biggie. I mean, that one's usually a lot of reading. Any chance of maybe making it 10 days?
Yeah. And we can work, depending on when the meeting is in November, I'm likely
it should
not
be
be
the 15th.
Here. Mara will be covering for me, but so depending on if we do that in November or in February, I think the timing in February would probably work fine.
Yeah, probably next year.
And then we'll make sure to get all of that information for you and plenty of time.
We'll be more than happy. Maybe I'll be going to New York.
What are you doing?
So,
selling the bonds.
Oh.
You want to come?
In January?
So on page 5 shows...
I'll pay for the thing if we do it in the Bahamas. We'll just forget that.
Oh, gosh. Where the 10 and 30-year U.S. Treasury versus the AAA BVOL rates have been over the past 3 years. For both the 10 and 30 year on each of these.
It's like a cardiogram.
And the spreads are starting to widen between the 10 and 30 on the BVOL, so we're not seeing that so much with the Treasuries yet, but compared to where we were back in 2021, but things are starting to look like maybe they'll normalize, and keep watching the yield curve to see if we'll get rid of that inversion. So if there's no questions on the market, slide 7 will dive into the tax anticipation note.
What would trigger a dramatic swing more than expected in these for us? What kind of news, what kind of
situation? Yeah, so COVID was a prime example where rates went haywire. You know, we had some where, you know, we're in a variable rate where it was reset weekly, and all of a sudden that was spiking, hitting the maximum rate. So something like that, you know, I'm assuming a 9/11 probably did that. What happened in 2008 with the recession, major economic events like that, I think, caused those huge spikes. Otherwise,
so the Hamas deal did not? And the Ukraine deal did not do much of a blip?
So what, that was back in October?
It'll be a year. Is the Hamas thing. The Ukraine thing, what, it's now 3 years, isn't it?
More than
that. Is it? Yeah. I'm just trying to, so as we're watching things, as I did in the prior report this morning, I'm trying to pick up little anecdotal things so I can be monitoring and looking and see what's happening. So, hey, Ivan, what about this? What about that? Let's call a meeting, something like that.
Yeah, I think within the tax-exempt community market, the BVOL that we're pricing off of, it's more sort of the local. When you're talking about a big swing, I mean, we see shifts. Like in a day, we have seen 30 or 40 basis points movement, but if that trend continues, is then when you kind of see the spike of what happened when COVID set. So otherwise, you know, in a week, we can see kind of massive swings within the market rights itself. Like, for example, investors are already baking in that the Fed is going to cut rates in September. If that doesn't happen, you'll see a big swing back. And that's kind of been going on for the past several years, that it's sort of been swinging, that investors are anticipating a certain thing. And if it happens, then it's calm. If it doesn't, then they overreact. Very knee-jerky kind of lately, I would say, as a whole. But the big, huge ones you're talking about are going to be major economic events here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we did go out for the annual tax anticipation note.
Is there any way I could take a 3-minute recess?
Sure.
Hit the